Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahual podcast and YouTube video series. And today my guest is from Washington, D.C., Nick Danforth. Nick, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be back here.
Good to be back with you too, Nick. Nicholas Danforth is a visiting scholar at Elliott School at George Washington University, a very well-known, prominent Turkey observer and analyst, very prolific too lately, since the change and transition of power in Washington. Nick is one of those who is busy writing comprehensive reports about Turkey in the context of NATO, in the context of Eastern Mediterranean, in the context of region, but also mainly in the context of Turkish-American relations. And this,
lots to write about these days.
Yes, and it is now a very fresh report. He wrote for the Brookings Institute, and this is titled Between Cooperation and Containment, New U.S. Policies for a New Turkey, a very comprehensive one, and a rather gloomy one as well, as the other reports by the Center for American Progress and what we have heard from Mark Pierini with Carnegie Europe, and the other was CAP, Max Hoffman. So this one is also filled with very sharp observations. In this, you say that, and that's the already at the beginning, very interesting dimension that you bring forth, which is since 2016, new security doctrine, as you call it, started to take shape in Ankara vis-a-vis West in general, NATO, and also USA. What is this new security doctrine? Or it's not new, we have followed it, but what is this? And what is the root cause of it?
Well, let me maybe step back and say one thing first. I mean, you characterized the report as gloomy, which is certainly fair. And a number of other reports that have come out, I would also agree, are definitely gloomy. But I think it's worth just adding before we get too pessimistic, and I am very pessimistic, but part of the reason I think so there has been such a relentless emphasis on the gloomy is because, well, everyone expected that U.S.-Turkish relations would just continue to be bad, if not get slightly worse under Biden. For some reason, as soon as he got elected, you had this narrative that some people were very eagerly trying to promote, that there would be a reset, that things would get better. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of the relentless gloominess you see is simply people trying to say, you know, it's not going to get better. And it's only in the context of some people insisting surreally, irrationally, I think, that there is a possibility for things to get better, that many of us have tried to emphasize all the reasons why that will be difficult. With that out of the way, to your question,
I think I should also add here, Nick, that I fully agree with you. The words like pessimist, gloomy, is something that we discuss amongst ourselves with other people as well. But I think all of them point out to one fact. The more realistic the assessments and analysis about the current state of affairs with Turkey, domestically or internationally speaking, the more valuable they are. And pessimistic
or
dark as they may sound or look, realism is the winner at the end of the day. So, of course, it would look gloomy, but it's realistic. It's utterly realistic, the entire report. That's also something that we should add. So let's go back to the question.
So what's odd to me about this whole phenomenon is that, so, you know, you have the Turkish government saying quite explicitly, you have Erdogan saying and people around Erdogan saying very eagerly that they have a new approach to foreign policy, that Turkey is no longer going to deal with the West the same way it did in the past. It's, you know, they cast it as no longer being subservient or beholden to the United States and the West, emphasizing that they're going to be more independent. And yet then when you as an American analyst look at this, hear what they're saying and say, you know, whether you think this is a good policy or not, it is going to cause increased tension with the United States and the West, then you're criticized for, you know, trying to sabotage U.S.-Turkish relations. What I've been trying to say, and what I think many other people are trying to say, is, you know, we have to take Turkey's statements about its own foreign policy seriously. And if Turkey, you know, is insistent that it's no longer, that it wants to have a more independent foreign policy instead of behaving in lockstep with NATO the way it, many people think it did before. I mean, I think that's something people in the West have to acknowledge and recognize, that that is going to create problems. And, you know, you see on the issue of the S-400, just the most prominent one, you know, a very clear example of how, if Turkey is a NATO member, wants to have a more independent foreign policy that involves buying Russian weapons, that's going to cause problems with NATO. I don't, you know, it seems like a very neutral thing to point out, and one that the same people in Turkey promoting this independent foreign policy should be willing to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. Right. In the beginning already, you point out also something very, I would say, correct and blunt, which is Turkish government views the United States as a strategic threat rather than an ally. And the growing majority in Washington have come to view Turkey the same way. This suggests that all this, you know, strategic partnership talk that we heard during Obama, which we heard fading during Trump administration period, is no longer. I mean, we don't speak about it in those terms, but you suggest that it's not a strategic ally. It's not an ally, but what is viewed as a strategic threat now, which is quite striking, isn't it?
I mean, and again, it's not, you know, there's a cyclical nature to this. There's a self-fulfilling element, which is that at the point where Turkey starts to see the United States and the West as a threat and starts calibrating its foreign policy in terms of pushing back against that perceived threat, that's very quickly going to create anger, frustration, and ultimately a sense of threat amongst especially Turkey's neighbors, but also increasingly policymakers in Washington and Europe. And it's, I think when people try to be optimistic about this, they point to a lot of frustrations that Turkey has had with the United States. You know, the fact that Turkey wasn't able to buy the Patriots when it wanted to, that it wasn't given the tech transfer that it wanted with missile deals from the United States, and emphasize that this frustration has led to decisions like buying the S-400. And I think when you couch things in those terms, you know, we can quibble about exactly where to place the blame, but it still points towards a solution. If Turkey is frustrated with not getting the support from the United States with the S-400, I mean, with missile defense in Syria, that can lead to, you know, the relationship being saved by the U.S. giving Turkey more support. That's a very different analysis from saying, you know, Turkey bought the S-400 because it views the United States as a threat. It wasn't that it was frustrated with not getting enough support from the United States. It actually thought the United States was attacking it, was actually trying to bring down the Erdogan regime. Those are very different analyses, and they lead to very different conclusions. One more optimistic, one much more pessimistic. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for the people who are trying to promote good U.S.-Turkish relations in Washington when they try to present the more sanitized version of Turkey's frustrations or expectations, and then continuously keep getting undercut by Erdogan saying, you know, it's actually not that we're frustrated with the United States, it's that we think the United States is our primary threat.
Mm-hmm. What were the, again, let's stay on this part, what were the main elements, components of this change of the new security doctrine? Did the Erdogan government administration lose faith in the United States and started to steer the ship towards a direction which is sort of between East and West, between Russia and the West system, if you will. But there were other elements as well. I mean, because you mentioned correctly, and it's a very important part, that it's a coalition that now it's in power in Ankara, not only Erdogan and purely his party, but there are other elements as well, ideology, but also I think weakness of the European Union, maybe also in the past 12-13 months, Corona, which turned every nation inward. But I think you have some very clear points that need to be shared with the viewers and listeners here. What were the main elements for this change?
Right, because with every big change, it requires a lot of factors coming together. And I think you've outlined a number of the big ones. But I mean, right, you have domestic politics in Turkey, you have an ideological element to it, you have changing geopolitical conditions and changing regional conditions. And yeah, I think they've all come together in a very unique way. And it's precisely the fact that you do have so many of these different factors come together that's going to make it very difficult to untangle. Yeah, I mean, certainly the suspicion of the West, the hostility towards the West has been, you know, something in Erdogan's thinking, you know, going back a long time. It's certainly been a factor in Islamist thinking in Turkey and nationalist thinking in Turkey. That combined with the revival of Turkey's Kurdish conflict, which drove both an increased securitization of Turkish foreign policy, also an alliance between Erdogan and nationalist factions, which were often very suspicious of or hostile to the West. You know, I think we talked about this last time I was on here with you. You know, a geopolitical climate, or sorry, a regional climate in which, you know, because of the coup in Egypt, because of the Eastern Mediterranean gas issue, you've got, you know, a number of actors coming together in a kind of what they see as an effort to contain Islamist influence in the Middle East. You know, so you have countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the UAE, which now for ideological reasons are hostile, increasingly hostile to Erdogan. And you also, you know, writ large, and this is something that Turkish commentators have often brought up, you know, you do have the sense that the world is becoming more multilateral, that fantasies about kind of economic integration are breaking down, that you have a more violent and chaotic world in which hard power certainly is playing a bigger role. You know, this post-Cold War kind of fantasy about liberal internationalism spreading throughout the region and rendering hard power and conflict obsolete has disappeared. So I think whereas, you know, Turkish foreign policy, you know, when you go back to under Davutoğlu, always saw a more prominent role for Turkey in the region. In, let's say, the early 2000s through the Arab Spring, it was easier for Turkey to imagine its more prominent role operating kind of broadly in parallel with what was this Western vision of spreading the liberal international order through the Middle East. You know, you hear Davutoğlu talk about the kind of influence that Turkey aspired to in the Middle East. It almost at times seemed like he was imagining Turkey as kind of the Germany to a regional EU, where it was going to be soft power, it was going to be economic influence, it was going to be diplomacy that gave Turkey its influence. That world, you know, because of the failure of the Arab Spring, because of the Syrian civil war, maybe talk about Russian actions in the Ukraine, that world is gone. You now see a much more aggressive, violent, unstable world. And so I would also say, in part, Turkey's new focus on hard power is a response to that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder now, and you point out this in various levels in the report, this results of these, or achievements or non-achievements of this new security policy. What are those? Did Erdogan benefit at all with this, what you call, as a result of this, I think you call it very spot-on, combative foreign policy? You know, we used assertive, but it's more than assertive. It is, some people use as aggressive, but I think it's definitely combative. It is almost unilaterally you know, straight, you know, forthcoming and pushy. What are these achievements and non-achievements? And what, at the end of the day, when facing Biden and facing Washington, does Erdogan and his government will they have anything at hand to sort of, you know, push back Biden and his team?
And that's what's been really difficult to obviously, you know, try to evaluate the success of Turkey's foreign policy in a neutral way. And people are always projecting whether they wanted to succeed or not onto their analyses. So I think to try to be balanced, you have to acknowledge that there have been some very real gains from Turkey's use of hard power, but also that these carry a lot of risks and that these have had consequences that I think people might not see because of their ideological assumptions. And what I mean by that is, you know, I think a lot of Turkish foreign policy thinking has been driven by the assumption that there is this existing deep hostility already towards Turkey from a lot of regional players and Western actors. And when you see, you know, the use of force in that context, you know, the concrete gains that Turkey has made on the ground, you know, I mean, in Libya, they stopped Haftar's assault on Tripoli. In Nagorno-Karabakh, obviously helped Azerbaijan win a very decisive victory. You know, in Idlib, it's more difficult. They've maybe slowed down the pace of Russian advances. It's not clear they're going to be able to stop Russian advances. You know, some real on the gain grounds, you know, but I do think, you know, those have to be acknowledged, but also set against the fact that it's this use of hard power that has, in fact, alienated many other countries and that has created the kind of geopolitical adversity that Turkey now faces. And so I think, yeah, I mean, I think there's a trade-off. You know, I think you can continue to get kind of short-term on-the-ground gains through this approach, but at the expense of, you know, undermining relations with longstanding partners and allies, which could, you know, depending on how things turn out, leave Turkey in a more vulnerable position down the line. I think this is especially pertinent with the relationship with Russia. You know, Russia and Turkey have created this very complicated relationship in a number of forums where, on one hand, Russian and Turkish proxies are often squaring off against each other, but at the same time, both governments are touting their ability to resolve regional disputes by working together and without Western interference. In this, you know, so on one hand, Turkey is balancing Russia. On the other hand, through its involvement, its competition with Russia in these many theaters, it's actually strengthening Russia's hand as well, undermining the influence of other Western players. You know, and again, in the short term, this brings real benefits to Turkey. The risk is, in the long run, you know, I think for all the military strength that Turkey has, when it finds itself one-on-one against Russia and Russia really feels like its interests and red lines are at stake, that's going to be a difficult situation for Turkey. Mm.
It's interesting because many people now agree that the real winner in Karabakh conflict is not really Azerbaijan. It's not Turkey. I mean, the major real winner is Russia. Which
I'd say it's definitely Azerbaijan. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, people do say that, but if you put them in a hierarchical order, I've seen many people suggest that it's Russia because it has reasserted its power, military presence. It's calling the shots again, much more powerfully. Of course, Turkey gained a lot because it's widened the doors to its backyard. And strengthened and consolidated its relations with Baku, etc. But as you also point out in your report, it's Russia is treading very carefully and strategically because I think it set the limits for Turkey now in Karabakh. Many people agree or suggest. And also in Syria, in Idlib, as you also point out, at the end of the day, whenever something threatens Russia's regional interests, it knows how to, you know, set barriers for Turkey. So in terms of that, I mean, maybe if you disagree, of course, just say it. But in terms of Russia dimension, will Erdogan have any arguments in the favor of resetting to some level American-Turkish relations in the context of Russia? Because one aide recently said, "Oh, Erdogan is the only sort of Western leader that can, you know, communicate with Putin," but that doesn't sound like a really convincing argument per se, is it?
No, and I think, look, I mean, I think that might be the best argument they have, but it's still going to be a hard sell in Washington. You know, look, there are people who are still worried about losing Turkey. There are people who are worried about what kind of a strengthened Turkish-Russian cooperation would, you know, the threat that would present for the United States. But it's also becoming increasingly difficult for Turkey to convince anyone in Washington that it can still be, you know, a reliable partner in trying to contain the Soviet Union. You know, and it's a challenge in part because rhetorically Ankara has continuously emphasized how well it can cooperate with Russia. It's a challenge because of the S-400 issue. You know, and then now people in Turkey have been talking about buying new consignments of Russian weapons. And it's also, you know, on one hand, Turkey is trying to argue that it's successfully containing Russia already through its involvement in all these different theaters. People are skeptical that that's actually successful. But at the same time, even if you did assume that Turkey's efforts to contain Russia were successful right now, then it would raise the question of, okay, well, if Turkey's already doing this for its own interests, if Turkey's already, because of its own foreign policy goals, working to counter Russia in all these areas, then why is this an argument for the United States to improve relations with Turkey?
Right.
Turkey can keep doing its thing, and you know that will help balance Russia as much as Turkey's going to. We don't have to give Turkey any extra concessions on that account.
Mm-hmm. So, just in that part, there are two new updates. One is Jim Jeffrey, who was very, very active in Syria policy. Said S-400s are the only issue between Turkey and America.
Didn't he say it was the main issue?
Main issue, but which means that in a way he said it. It said, you know, if that issue is out of the way, there won't be any other issues on the way. So, you know, it makes that kind of sense or perception is inevitably that way. What do you think?
You know, it was interesting, right? So at the same time that came out, there were also reports that Turkey had been, that Hulusi Akar had suggested the Crete solution to the S-400s.
Yes, let's also tell the viewers and listeners that Hulusi Akar, the former top general, now defense minister, today in a large interview with Hurriyet said, in a way, you know, in a nutshell, we are ready to discuss S-400 issue. We can bury them. We can dump them like the Greeks or Cypriots did with S-300s. And this is what is called the Cretan model. And also another anonymous source told Bloomberg today that Turkey is ready to negotiate S-400s as long as U.S. is ready to negotiate seizing help or assistance to YPG in Syria. So all these things are piled up together, but I think we will hear more about these issues as S-400-focused way.
And it's still, you know, it's always, you see the headlines around these statements, and they always seem very optimistic and make it look like there's room for compromise. And I haven't really had a chance to dig into the statements that just came out today, but usually when you do, there end up being a lot of caveats that make it a lot harder to be optimistic. I mean, consistently, the United States and Turkey have both been very eager to say we should solve the S-400 issue. The United States' solution is that Turkey gets rid of the X-400s and we lift sanctions. Turkey's solution is always we keep the S-400s and we keep using them and you don't sanction us. So, you know, when they talk about the Crete model, if the proposal is that Turkey will only use the S-400s sometimes and America lifts sanctions, that's going to be a hard sell. You know, it would, and certainly then when you add the caveat of this will only happen in response to America cutting off support for the YPG, then all of a sudden it goes back to being a non-starter, I think.
Also, the leaving S-400s to the hands of NATO, which Turkey is part of, would inevitably anger Moscow, and that would have arguably some consequences in relations between Turkey and Russia, one should add. Okay, we covered Russia. We have a couple of questions more. There are four flashpoints. Russia was one, and we covered that. But there are other flashpoints now that need to be approached, that need to be tackled. One is the Eastern Mediterranean. The third one is Syria. And also we have the what you call legality issues, which is basically Halkbank issue. You know, Eastern Mediterranean is in a way a NATO issue as well, because S-400 was a sort of a NATO ally purchasing, you know, Russian equipment. And the Eastern Mediterranean, again, a NATO ally perceived as very threatful by another NATO ally, Greece, in Eastern Mediterranean. So what about Eastern Mediterranean and Syria?
I mean, look, on the Eastern Mediterranean, the one positive thing you can say is at least it does seem like Turkey has opted to kind of put this on the back burner for a little bit. We now have a talk of negotiations over Cyprus. Greece and Turkey are holding preliminary talks on, well, to figure out what they're going to talk about on the Eastern Med issue. You know, I don't think anyone, I certainly don't think that these are going to go anywhere. I don't think you're going to get a solution to Cyprus. I don't think you're going to get some kind of major diplomatic breakthrough between Turkey and Greece. But at least the fact that both sides are having talks about it instead of the kind of saber-rattling and gumbo diplomacy we had last summer is a positive development. And at least it keeps that issue off the radar, keeps it from escalating. And the longer that stays, that approach, and keep up that approach, the better. The Syria interest issue is interesting because I do think if there are any, you know, flashpoints between Turkey and Russia that are worth talking about, the Idlib situation really is explosive. And, you know, Turkey and Russia have done a good job of maintaining a cooperative combative relationship where they keep, you know, they're clearly at odds with each other over a lot of things, but they maintain the framework of trying to solve this in a constructive way between them. That is going to get increasingly difficult in Idlib, I think. You know, what we've seen before is consistently whenever Russia and the Assad regime pushed on Idlib, you know, at the end of the day, Turkey would fall back and we'd see a new agreement. We'd see a new ceasefire that essentially consolidated gains by the Assad regime. We saw that last spring, although it was a little more explosive that time. I mean, Turkey did push back, just did a lot of damage to Syrian equipment. You know, but at the end of the day, when Russia decided it was serious, either Russian or Syrian planes with Russian support bombed a Turkish convoy, killed 33 Turkish soldiers, and the pattern continued. You know, at the end of the day, the Turkish government went to Moscow and they signed a new agreement that conceded the M5 highway to the regime. That said, since then, Turkey has poured an enormous amount of equipment and personnel into Idlib. It seems to be very insistent in saying that this pattern is not going to repeat itself. Given the sheer, you know, I think some people still think this is a bluff on Turkey's part. Given the number of troops that they've put in there, it's hard for me to imagine it's completely a bluff. It's also hard for me to imagine what those forces will do if, like last spring, you know, Russia and the regime started bombing them.
One speaks about 100,000 troops or something close to that.
I mean, you've heard, yeah, it's, you know, by a wide range of estimates. But, you know, so I don't think Turkey is planning on just withdrawing them as soon as they start getting attacked from the air. But it's also not clear to me, you know, again, just given the dynamics, what they could actually do on the ground to change that. So I do, you know, as I said, I do think Turkey and Russia have been very eager to maintain the appearance of a collaborative relationship, but I do think Idlib will create some serious strain there.
Mm-hmm. And we have a Halkbank issue as well, which is the fourth flashpoint,
right,
which I think is equally, if not more, important as the S-400 issue.
Right. I mean, so in March, you're going to have a new trial about Turkey's support for for Iranian sanction busting. This is something that was delayed by the Trump regime at Erdogan's request. That no longer sustainable. Obviously, no one expects that Biden is going to do that. The assumption is that the trial will move forward, and that a large fine would eventually be leveraged against Halkbank. You know, and again, estimates go up in the sort of $10 billion range. Part of what makes this explosive is in the past that Turkish government, whereas other companies and countries have negotiated these fines and to try to bring them down, the Turkish government refused to do that. And, you know, at a certain point, it looked like Halk Bank wasn't even going to acknowledge the legitimacy of the case against it, which would have triggered a whole new set of fines. And so that dynamic, the fact that you wouldn't just have a legal ruling against Turkey, but that you could have Turkey or Halk Bank refuse to recognize that legal ruling, much less, you know, negotiate down the penalty for it, could lead this to escalate in a way that goes beyond just the fine itself.
Mm-hmm. And you say Turkey now presents, having gone through all this with you, Turkey now presents the Biden administration not with a relationship to be restored, but with an unsolvable foreign policy problem to be managed and mitigated as best as possible. This is, in a nutshell, where we are in the relations, very historic rupture point. And you suggest or recommend or you see as the ways to deal with the, well, for the Biden administration, three points. One is planning around Turkey, not with Turkey anymore, planning around Turkey. Second is coordinating with allies and the partners to counter Turkish provocations, as you say it, so that, you know, things don't get worse. And the third one, leaving still the door open where possible for you know, for a transactional relationship, etc. Can you elaborate a little bit on these three points before we conclude?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd first say, you know, for a long time there was a debate about whether or not the way to save the relationship with Turkey through, you know, engagement or getting tough was through carrots or sticks.
Both elements are on now in Biden team. There are let's get tough guys and those let's continue appease guys. So right. We don't know who will, which side will win, but it will be interesting.
I think increasingly the dynamics have pushed, you know, are pushing everyone towards the let's get tough side of things. My point would be, you know, and I think that's inevitable and to a certain degree the right direction to go. I just also think, you know, there used
even to- also the Bob Menendez is now in the foreign policy committee of the Senate, right?
Exactly. You have some people, especially in Congress, who are very angry at Turkey and, you know, yes, could really push this in a very aggressive direction. And I think that could also go to an extreme, too, although we're not there yet. My point would simply be that much as I don't think engaging with Turkey or being extra nice to Erdogan was going to improve things, I also don't think even if, you know, getting tough is the lesser of two evils, is the right course. It's not like Erdogan's suddenly going to fall in line and start doing what the United States wants the moment we threaten him with sanctions either. I think some people were more optimistic about that. I think it's becoming clear that while Erdogan may make concessions under pressure, while there may be certain issues that he is willing to compromise on, this isn't going to be the solution either. You know, and part of the reason I tried to, you know, focus on the way Turkey at least has described its foreign policy thinking is it creates a paradox, a dilemma, whereby if Turkey assumes that the West is fundamentally hostile towards it and it has to use these aggressive measures to push back, the risk is that any tough measures the West takes simply confirm that sense of hostility, and yet any concessions the West offers it simply makes it look to people in Ankara like the aggressive pushback is working, thereby encouraging more of it. So I think that the dynamic is going to be very difficult to get out of. And that's why, you know, I think to the best extent, you know, the United States has already been doing this on a purely practical ground. You know, after the umpteenth time that Turkey threatened to close Incirlik, the United States has looked for more military basing options in the region. This has led the United States to draw closer to Greece, which has been eager to encourage the United States to make use of facilities on Greek soil. I think you'll see that developing. I think NATO, you know, in its planning is going to begin to count less and less on Turkey and Turkish cooperation in designing, you know, policies for the region. You know, at the same time, I was frustrated, if not surprised, to see that obviously a lot of the Turkish commentary on this, on my paper, focused on the word containment and made it sound like I was recommending a policy of containment writ large towards Turkey. The title was very explicit. It was between cooperation and containment. And yet there are moments, and I think this is the self-fulfilling aspect of Turkish policy, where when Turkey does seem to be challenging, let's say, international norms, as well as the security of America's partners in the region, this inevitably is going to lead the United States to try to cooperate with those countries in containing Turkey. And that, you know, things like the Libya Maritime Agreement, I mean, I'd cite that as just the most prominent example. That combined with some of the Turkish government's irredentist rhetoric over Greek islands really did alarm Greece. And it, you know, I think created a context where any U.S. government is likely to be more sympathetic to the Greek side. And, you know, you see the EU, you see Washington, all kind of very slowly, but gradually falling in line and looking at what, you know, again, it's been a very slow process, but the EU has gradually gotten more and more comfortable sanctioning Turkey over its conduct in the Eastern Med. I think inevitably you're going to see more of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I hope it happens in a coordinated, measured fashion, and I hope it happens in a way that gives Turkey off-ramps, you know, through negotiation. But I think it also, at some level, is a necessary step in, you know, preventing Turkey from claiming large swaths of its neighbors' exclusive economic zones or threatening them with its warships.
Right. And I think the most challenging part is the restore confidence, the minimum confidence between Turkey and the West in general. One thing I want to hear your take. It's not really so much on the report, but the role of the European Union. It is divided, and there are also clashing views about how to deal with Turkey. Also, and it's synchronized with what Biden administration will do in the near future with Turkey. That is very clear. It is public. But there are, as I said, clashing wills, particularly Spain, which has a lot of financial interests at stake, right, in Turkey, is very pushy about not imposing sanctions. On the contrary, increasing partnership, there's, as Sanchez government started to talk about, and Çavuşoğlu and Erdogan team, knowing that, they are also flirting more and more with Madrid, but also Italy, Malta, small one, but still has a vote, and also Germany in between. But Germany has never been willing to impose sanctions, playing soft, as many see as appeaser or enabler even. Will it be a big challenge for Biden to shape a coherent policy? Because when we are talking about EU, we are also talking about NATO, you know, which many of these countries are members of. Will it be a big challenge?
I start to glue these
components together in the European Union?
Right. I mean, I'm always a little skeptical of Americans who claim to understand the EU. There are obviously some who do very well. God knows I am not one of them. I don't, you know, hardly my area of expertise. From what I've seen, yes, I mean, it's not like the EU is going to operate in lockstep against Turkey. I don't think we're going to see them taking any draconian measures against Turkey. The divides that you mentioned that everyone else has observed seem very real. You know, the flip side of that is that for all that division, the fact that you've still seen enough unanimity to be able to even pass the very minor sanctions that the EU already has against certain Turkish individuals and companies over the East Med does suggest that, you know, the further Turkey goes with this, the more successful Erdogan will be in the Herculean task of actually uniting the European Union. You know, and it's, yes, I mean, there's sometimes this tendency in Turkey to present Germany as the good guy, to present Germany as the only country that is still standing up for them. And compared to France, that may be true, but, you know, I mean, especially Merkel certainly had no illusions about Erdogan. The frustration in Germany at a geopolitical level, but also at a domestic level, from what I understand, is growing. You know, eventually this is going to take its toll, and it's, you know, again, even if you don't see the EU kind of taking new draconian measures, you also have the fact that the dynamics that are in play, even without further escalation, have already been working against Turkey. And, you know, you don't, you know, when evaluating Turkish foreign policy, you know, the dramatic decline of the Turkish lira is not, of course, purely a product of foreign policy issues. There's a lot of other things at play, too. But it's certainly been exacerbated by Turkey's strained geopolitical relations. There's not, you know, there was a time when people were talking about Turkey signing a revised customs union, an updated customs union with the EU. From what I understand, there's absolutely no political will to do that anymore. You know, these are the kind of missed opportunities, the damage that's already happening because of these strained relations, I think also has to be calculated in and also has to be seen to some extent as a price of the policies Turkey's pursuing. And that if Turkey really wanted to change these dynamics, that now comes with growing expectations for the kind of policy concessions that the Europeans and Americans would be demanding of Turkey.
Nick, if you had to describe in one phrase the state of Turkish-American relations now and what's at stake, what would you say?
I usually just say bad. I think it's going to be a sort of ugly, hostile, confrontational dance for the coming few years. I think neither side is going to really want to cross a breaking point, that fall into the abyss. Turkey so far has always been willing to step back right when it seems like it's about to provoke, a truly drastic response from the United States. In the same time, especially with the Biden administration, these are cautious people. They're not going to want to do anything to, precipitate a crisis in Turkey. No one in Europe is going to want to impose the kind of sanctions that will push Turkey's economy off a cliff. So as a result, I think, you're going to have a very frustrating, hostile dance where you're going to see, provocations by Turkey. You're going to see slow but building responses from the West. You're then going to see Turkey take a step back. You're going to see the West sort of, go along with it, feign optimism, be willing to renegotiate, and have more talks. And this cycle is going to keep up, in a more and more strained way. And I don't ultimately know where it leads.
Mm-hmm. Between Cooperation and Containment, New U.S. Policies for a New Turkey. The author is Nick Danforth, joining me today. Nick, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Nick Danforth, visiting scholar at Elliott School at George Washington University. We had this conversation and we will continue this discussion and discourse about Turkey's foreign policy issues in the future as well. From Hot Pursuit, salutes to everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.